Chapter 38. That human happiness does not consist in the knowledge of God which is possessed generally by the majority. It remains for us to inquire in what kind of knowledge of God the ultimate happiness of the intellectual substance consists, for there is a certain general and confused knowledge of God, which is in almost all men, whether from the fact that, as some think, the existence of God, like other principles of demonstration, is self-evident, as we have stated in the first book, or, as seems nearer to the truth, because by his natural reason, man is able at once to arrive at some knowledge of God, foreseeing that natural things are arranged in a certain order, since there cannot be order without a cause of order. Men, for the most part, perceive that there is one who arranges in order the things that we see, but who or of what kind this cause of order may be, or whether there be but one, cannot be gathered from this general consideration. Even so, when we see a man in motion, and performing other works, we perceive that in him there is a cause of these operations, which is not in other things, and we give this cause the name of soul, but without knowing yet what the soul is, whether it be a body, or how it brings about operations in question. Now, this knowledge of God cannot possibly suffice for happiness, for the operation of the happy must be without any defect, and this knowledge is subject to an admixture of many errors. Some believe that there is no other ordainer of mundane things than the heavenly bodies, wherefore they said that the heavenly bodies are gods. Some ascribe this order to the elements and to the things generated from them, as though they deem the movements and natural operations thereof not to be due to another ordainer, and the order in other things to be caused by them. Some, deeming human acts not to be subject to any but a human ordinance, declared that men who cause order in other men are gods. Accordingly, this knowledge of God is not sufficient for happiness. Moreover, happiness is the end of human acts, but human acts are not directed to the aforesaid knowledge as their end. Indeed, it is in everyone almost from the very beginning. Therefore, happiness does not consist in this kind of knowledge of God. Again, no one appears to be blamed for lacking happiness; nay, those who have it not and seek it are praised. Whereas he who lacks the aforesaid knowledge of God is seemingly very much to be blamed, since it is a very clear sign of a man's dullness of perception if he failed to perceive such evident signs of God's existence, even as a man would be deemed dull who, seeing man, understood not that he has a soul. Hence it is said in the psalm, "The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God." Further, knowledge of a thing in general only, and not in respect of a property thereof, is most imperfect. For instance, knowledge of man from the fact that he is moved, for this is a knowledge whereby a thing is known only potentially, because the proper is only potentially contained in the common. Now, happiness is a perfect operation, and man's supreme good must needs be in respect of what he is actually, and not in respect of what he is only potentially, since potentiality perfected by act has the aspect of a good. Therefore, the aforesaid knowledge of God is not sufficient for our happiness. Chapter 39. That man's happiness does not consist in the knowledge of God acquired by demonstration. There is also another knowledge of God, higher than the one just mentioned, which is acquired by means of a demonstration, and which approaches nearer to a proper knowledge of him, since by means of a demonstration many things are removed from him, so that in consequence we understand him as something apart from other things. For demonstration proves that God is immovable, eternal, incorporeal, utterly simple, one, and the like, as we have shown in the first book. Now we arrive at the proper knowledge of a thing not only by affirmation, but also by negation, for just as it is proper to man to be a rational animal, so is it proper to him not to be inanimate or irrational. Yet there is this difference between these two modes of knowledge, that when we have proper knowledge of a thing by affirmation, we know what that thing is, and how it is distinguished from others, whereas when we have proper knowledge of a thing by negations, we know that it is distinct from others, but remain ignorant of what it is. Such is the proper knowledge of God, that can be obtained by demonstrations. But neither does this suffice for man's ultimate happiness. For things belonging to one species for the most part attain to the end of that species, because nature achieves its purpose always or nearly always, and fails in a few instances on account of some corruption. Now happiness is the end of the human species, since all men naturally desire it. Therefore happiness is a common good that can be attained by all men, unless some obstacle occur to some whereby they be debarred from it. Few, however, attain to the possession of the aforesaid knowledge of God by way of demonstration, on account of the obstacles to this knowledge, mentioned at the beginning of this work. Therefore this knowledge is not essentially man's happiness. Again, actual existence is the end of that which exists potentially, as was made clear above. Wherefore happiness that is the last end, is an act free of any potentiality to a further act. Now this knowledge of God that is acquired by way of demonstration is still in potentiality to a further knowledge of God, or to the same knowledge, but by a better way, because those who came afterwards endeavor to add something to the knowledge of God besides that which they found handed down to them by those who preceded them. Therefore such knowledge is not man's ultimate happiness. Further, happiness excludes all unhappiness, for no man can be at the same time happy and unhappy. Now deception and error have a large place in unhappiness, since all naturally avoid them. But the aforesaid knowledge of God is subject to the admixture of many errors, as evidenced by many who knew some truths about God through demonstration, yet, following their own opinions, when they lacked proof, fell into many errors. And if some there were who by the way of demonstration discovered the truth about divine things, without any admixture of error in their opinions, it is evident that they were very few, which is inconsistent with happiness, which should be the common end. Therefore man's ultimate happiness is not seated in such knowledge as this. Moreover, happiness consists in a perfect operation. Now perfect knowledge requires certitude, hence we cannot be said to know, unless we be certain that it cannot be otherwise, as stated in 1 poster 2. But the aforesaid knowledge is beset with uncertainty, as evidenced by the diversity of sciences about divine things, elaborated by those who endeavor to discover something about them by the way of demonstration. Therefore ultimate happiness does not consist in such like knowledge. Besides, when the will has obtained its last end, its desire is at rest. Now the ultimate end of all human knowledge is happiness. Therefore happiness is essentially that knowledge of God, the possession of which leaves no knowledge to be desired of anything knowable. Such, however, is not the knowledge which philosophers were able to have about God by the way of demonstration, because even when we have that knowledge we still desire to know something more, things that we know not by means of the aforesaid knowledge. Therefore happiness does not consist in such like knowledge of God. Furthermore, the end of everything that is in potentiality is that it be brought to actuality, for to this does it tend by means of the movement with which it is moved to its end. Now everything that is in potentiality tends to be actualized as far as possible, for there are things in potentiality in that their whole potentiality is reducible to act, so that the end of such a thing is that its whole potentiality be actualized. Thus a heavy body, that is outside its medium, is in potentiality to its proper place. There are also things whose potentiality cannot be actualized all at once, for instance primary matter, so that by its movement it is at it of actualization by various forms and succession, which cannot be in matter at the same time on account of their diversity. Now our intellect is in potentiality to all things intelligible, as stated in the second book. And it is possible for two intelligible objects to be in the possible intellect at the same time in respect of the first act, which is science, although perhaps not in respect of the second act, which is consideration. Accordingly it is clear that the whole potentiality of the possible intellect can be actualized at one time, and consequently this is required for its ultimate end, which is happiness. But the aforesaid knowledge which can be acquired about God by the way of demonstration, does this not affect this, since when we have it we still are ignorant of many things? Therefore such like knowledge of God does not suffice for ultimate happiness. Chapter 40. That man's happiness does not consist in the knowledge of God by faith. There is yet another knowledge of God, in one respect superior to the knowledge we have been discussing, namely that whereby God is known by men through faith. In this respect it surpasses the knowledge of God through demonstration, because by faith we know certain things about God, which are so sublime that reason cannot reach them by means of demonstration, as we have stated at the beginning of this work. But not even in this knowledge of God can man's ultimate happiness consist, for happiness is the intellect's perfect operation, as already declared. But in knowledge by faith the operation of the intellect is found to be most imperfect as regards that which is on the part of the intellect, although it is most perfect on the part of the object, for the intellect in believing does not grasp the object of its assent. Therefore neither does man's happiness consist in this knowledge of God. Again, it has been shown that ultimate happiness does not consist chiefly in an act of the will. Now in knowledge by faith the will has the leading place, for the intellect assents by faith to things proposed to it, because it wills, and not through being constrained by the evidence of their truth. Therefore man's final happiness does not consist in this knowledge. Besides, the believer assents to things proposed to him by another, but not seen by himself, so that the knowledge of faith resembles hearing rather than seeing. Now a man does not believe in what is unseen by him, and proposed to him by another, unless he thinks this other to have a more perfect knowledge of the things proposed than he himself has who sees not. Either therefore the believer thinks wrong, or the proposer must have more perfect knowledge of the things proposed. And if the latter also knows these things only through hearing them from another, we cannot proceed thus indefinitely, for then the assent of faith would be without foundation or certitude, since we should not come to some first principle certain in itself, to give certitude to the faith of believers. But it is not possible that the assent of faith be false and without foundation, as is clear from what we have said at the beginning of this work. And yet if it were false and baseless, happiness could not consist in such like knowledge. There is therefore some knowledge of God that is higher than the knowledge of faith, whether he who proposes faith sees the truth immediately, as when we believe Christ, or receive the truth from him who sees it immediately, as when we believe the apostles and prophets. Since then man's happiness consists in the highest knowledge of God, it cannot consist in the knowledge of faith. Moreover, since happiness is the last end, the natural desire is set at rest thereby. But the knowledge of faith does not set the desire at rest, but inflames it, because everyone desires to see what he believes. Therefore man's ultimate happiness does not consist in the knowledge of faith. Further, knowledge of God has been declared to be the end, inasmuch as it unites us to the last end of all, namely God. Now the knowledge of faith does not make the thing believed to be perfectly present to the mind, since faith is of distant and not present things. Wherefore the apostle says that so long as we walk by faith, we are pilgrims from the Lord. Yet faith makes God to be present to the heart, since the believer assents to God voluntarily, according to the saying of Ephesians 3:17, that Christ made well by faith in our hearts. Therefore the knowledge of faith cannot be man's ultimate happiness. Chapter 41. Is it possible for man, in this life, to understand separate substances by the study and inquiry of speculative sciences? The intellectual substance has yet another knowledge of God, for we have said in the second book, that the separate intellectual substance, by knowing its own essence, knows both what is above it and what is below it, in a way proportional to its substance. This must especially be the case, if that which is above it be its cause, since the likeness to the cause must be found in the effect. Wherefore, since God is the cause of all created intellectual substances, as proved above, it follows that separate intellectual substances, by knowing their own essence, know God himself by the way of some kind of vision, for the intellect knows by the way of vision the thing whose likeness is in the intellect, just as the likeness of the thing seen by the body is in the sense of the seer. Whatever intellect, therefore, apprehends a separate substance, by knowing what it is, sees God in a higher way than he is known by any of the kinds of knowledge mentioned above. Accordingly, whereas some have deemed man's ultimate happiness to be in this life, for the reason that he knows separate substances, We must inquire whether in this life man be able to know separate substances, and it is a point that may well be questioned, for our intellect, according to its present state, understands nothing without a phantasm, which stands in the same relation to the possible intellect, whereby we understand, as colors to the sight, as was made clear in the second book. Hence if, through the intellectual knowledge which is acquired from phantasms, it be possible for any of us to succeed in understanding separate substances, it will be possible in this life for someone to understand these same separate substances, and in consequence, by seeing these separate substances, he will participate in that mode of knowledge with which the separate substance, by understanding itself, understands God. If, on the other hand, by knowledge derived from phantasms, it be altogether unable to succeed in understanding separate substances, it will be impossible for man in the present state of life to acquire the above mode of divine knowledge. The possibility of succeeding in understanding separate substances, through knowledge derived from phantasms, has been explained by some in various ways. Of Empace, maintained that by the study of speculative sciences, it is possible to arrive at a knowledge of separate substances, from understanding those things which we know through phantasms, for we are able by the action of the intellect to extract the quiddity of a thing which has quiddity without being its quiddity, because the intellect is naturally adapted to know any quiddity as such, since the proper object of the intellect is what a thing is. Now if that which is first understood by the possible intellect is something that has a quiddity, we can, by the possible intellect, abstract the quiddity of the thing first understood, and if this quiddity has again a quiddity, it will be again possible to abstract the quiddity of this quiddity. And since we cannot go on indefinitely, we must stop somewhere. Therefore, by way of analysis, our intellect can arrive at knowing a quiddity that has no quiddity, and such is the quiddity of a separate substance. Consequently, through its knowledge of these sensibles, that is acquired from phantasms, our intellect can arrive at understanding separate substances. He goes on to prove the same statement by another yet similar way. Thus, he lays down that the idea of a thing, for instance of a horse, in me and in you is multiplied only through the multiplication of the spiritual forms, which are different in you and me. It follows then that an idea which is not clothed with any such form, is the same in you and me. Now, as we have proved, the quiddity of the idea, which our intellect by its innate aptitude abstracts, has no spiritual and individual form, for the quiddity of the idea is not the quiddity of the individual, whether corporeal or spiritual, since the thing understood, as such, is universal. Therefore our intellect has a natural aptitude to understand a quiddity the idea of which is the same in all. Such is the quiddity of a separate substance. Therefore our intellect has a natural aptitude to know separate substances. Yet, if we consider the matter carefully, these explanations are frivolous. For since the idea as such is universal, the quiddity of an idea must be the quiddity of a universal, namely genus or species. Now the quiddity of the genus or species of these sensible objects, the intellective knowledge whereof we acquire through phantasms, includes both matter and form. Consequently it is quite unlike the quiddity of a separate substance, which is simple and immaterial. Therefore it is impossible to understand the quiddity of a separate substance, through understanding the quiddity of a sensible object. Again, a form that cannot as to its very being be separated from a particular subject is not of the same kind as a form which, in its being, is separated from a particular subject, although both may be considered apart from that particular subject. For magnitude is not the same kind of thing as a separate substance, unless we suppose there are separated magnitudes midway between the species and the sensible object, as some Platonists have maintained. But the quiddity of a genus or species of sensible things cannot be separated in its very being, from a particular individual matter, unless perhaps, as the Platonists think, we suppose the species of things to exist separately, which Aristotle has refuted. Consequently the aforesaid quiddity is altogether different from separate substances, which are nowise in matter. Therefore it does not follow from the fact that these quiddities are understood, that separate substances can be understood. Moreover, if we grant that the quiddity of a separate substance is of the same kind as the quiddity of the genus or species of these sensible things, it cannot be said to be of the same specific kind, unless we say that the species of these sensible things are the separate substances themselves. As the Platonists maintained, it follows that they are only of the same kind in the point of quiddity as such, namely in the common ratio of genus and substance. Consequently, by means of these quiddities we shall understand nothing about separate substances except their immote genus. Now by knowing the genus, we do not therefore know the species except potentially. Therefore it will not be possible to understand a separate substance through understanding the quiddities of these sensible things. Besides, a separate substance differs more from sensible things than one sensible from another. But understanding the quiddity of one sensible does not suffice for understanding the quiddity of another. For a man who is born blind is quite unable through understanding the quiddity of sound to understand the quiddity of color. Much less therefore will anyone, through understanding the quiddity of a sensible substance, be able to understand the quiddity of a separate substance. Further, if again we grant that the spheres of the separate substance are causes of movement, and that by their movement they cause the forms of sensible substances, this mode of knowing separate substances through sensible things does not suffice for knowing their quiddity, because from the effect we know its cause either in the point of likeness between cause and effect, or in this, that the effect indicates the power of the cause. In the point of likeness, we do not gather from the effect what the cause is, unless agent and effect be of one species, and this is not the case with separate substances and sensible things. In the point of power, it is again impossible unless the effect equal the power of the cause, since then the whole power of the cause is known from the effect, and the power of a thing indicates its substance. But this cannot apply to the point in question, because the powers of separate substances surpass all the sensible effects that our intellect understands, even as a universal power surpasses a particular effect. It is therefore impossible through understanding sensible objects to arrive at understanding separate substances. Moreover, whatever intelligible things we are able to know by means of inquiry and study belong to one or other of the speculative sciences. Accordingly, if through understanding the natures and quiddities of these sensible objects we succeed in understanding separate substances, it follows that it would be possible to understand separate substances through one or the other speculative science. Yet we do not find this to be the case, for no speculative science teaches what any separate substance is, but only the fact that it is. It is therefore not possible to succeed in understanding separate substances through understanding the natures of sensible objects. And if it be said that such a speculative science is possible, although it has not yet been discovered, this makes no difference, since it is not possible, from any principles known to us, to arrive at understanding the aforesaid substances, because all the proper principles of any science whatever depend on the first indemonstrable self-evident principles, the knowledge of which we acquire from sensible objects, as stated in 2 Poster 15, and sensible objects do not sufficiently lead to the knowledge of immaterial things, as we have proved in the preceding arguments. Therefore no science is possible whereby one may be able to attain to the understanding of separate substances. Chapter 42. That in this life we are unable to know separate substances in the manner proposed by Alexander. Alexander supposed the possible intellect to be subject to generation and corruption, on account of its being a disposition of human nature resulting from the mixture of the elements, as we have seen in the second book. Now it is not possible for a power of this kind to arise above the material world, and so he maintained that our possible intellect can never attain to the understanding of separate substances. But he held that, according to our present state of life, we are able to understand separate substances. He endeavored to prove this as follows. Whenever a thing is completed as regards being generated, and has reached the ultimate perfection of its substance, its proper operation, whether action or passion, will also be completed, for even as operation follows substance, So does perfection of operation follow perfection of substance, wherefore an animal, when quite perfect, is able to walk by itself. Now the habitual intellect, which is nothing else but the intelligible species formed by the active intellect, and residing in the possible intellect, has a twofold operation. One is to make things potentially understood to be actually understood, and this it has in reference to the active intellect, while the other is to understand what is actually understood, for man is able to do these two things by an intellectual habit. Accordingly, when the generation of the habitual intellect is complete, both of these operations will be completed in the intellect. Now whenever the intellect acquires new species, it reaches the complement of its generation, and so its generation must necessarily be completed eventually, unless there be an impediment, since no generation tends to the infinite. Therefore eventually both operations will be completed in the habitual intellect, by its making all things potentially understood to be understood actually, which is the complement of the first operation, and by understanding all things intelligible, both separate and not separate. And seeing that the possible intellect is unable to understand separate substances, according to his opinion, as we have stated, he means that we shall understand separate substances by the habitual intellect, insofar as the active intellect, which according to him is a separate substance, will become the form of the habitual intellect and be united to us, so that thereby we shall understand, even as now we understand by the possible intellect. And, since it is in the power of the active intellect to make things actually understood, which are intelligible potentially, and to understand separate substances, in that state we shall understand separate substances, and all non-separate intelligible things. According to this explanation, by this knowledge which we derive from phantasms, we attain to the knowledge of the separate substance, not as though the phantasms themselves and the things understood from them were a means for knowing separate substances, as happens in speculative sciences, which was the position of the previous opinion, but because the intelligible species are in us a kind of disposition to this particular form, which is the active intellect. This is the first point of difference between these two opinions. Consequently, when the habitual intellect becomes perfect through these intelligible species produced in us by the active intellect, the active intellect itself becomes a form united to us, as stated, and he calls this the acquired intellect, which, they state, Aristotle held to come from without. And so, although man's ultimate perfection is not seated in the speculative sciences, as the previous opinion maintained, yet by them man is disposed for the attainment of his ultimate perfection. This is the second point of difference between the second and first opinions. Thirdly, they differ in this, that, according to the first opinion, the active intellect's act of understanding is the cause of its union with us, whereas, in the second opinion, the reverse is the case, since it is because it is united to us as a form that we understand it and other separate substances. But there is no reason in these statements, for the habitual intellect, like the possible intellect, is supposed by Alexander to be subject to generation and corruption. Now according to him, an eternal thing cannot become the form of that which can be generated and corrupted, for this is why he maintains that the possible intellect, which is united to us as a form, is subject to generation and corruption, and that the active intellect, which is incorruptible, is a separate substance. Since then, according to Alexander, the active intellect is supposed to be an eternal separate substance, it will be impossible for the active intellect to become the form of the habitual intellect. Again, the form of the intellect, as intellect, is the intelligible, just as the form of the sense is the sensible, for the intellect does not receive a thing, properly speaking, except intelligibly, as neither does the sense, except sensibly. If then the active intellect cannot become an intelligible through the habitual intellect, it cannot possibly be its form. Besides, there are three ways in which we are said to understand by means of something. First, we understand by means of the intellect, which is the power that elicits this operation, wherefore also the intellect may be said to understand, and the very act of the intellect in understanding becomes our act of understanding. Secondly, We understand by means of the intelligible species whereby we are said to understand, not as though the species itself understood, but because the intellective power is actuated by it, just as the power of sight is by the species of color. Thirdly, as by a medium through knowing which we arrive at the knowledge of something else. If, then, man at length understands separate substances through his intellect, it must be in one of these ways. It is not in the third way, because Alexander does not grant that either the possible or the habitual intellect understands the active intellect. Nor is it in the second way, because to understand by means of an intelligible species is ascribed to the intellective power that is informed by that species, yet Alexander does not grant that either the possible or the habitual intellect understands separate substances, and consequently we cannot possibly understand separate substances by means of the active intellect in the same way as we understand things by means of an intelligible species. And if it is as by an intellective power, it follows that the active intellect's act of understanding is the man's act of understanding. Now this cannot be unless the substance of the active intellect and the substance of the man be joined together in unity of being, for it is impossible that there be identity of operation where there is distinction of substances. Hence the active intellect will be one in being with man, but not in respect of accidental being, because the active intellect would then be not a substance but an accident. For instance, color added to a body makes one according to accidental being. It would follow then, that the active intellect together with man makes one in substantial being. Therefore it will be either the human soul or a part thereof, and not a separate substance, as Alexander maintained. Therefore the opinion of Alexander does not explain how man can understand separate substances. Moreover, if the active intellect at any time become the form of this particular man, so that he be able to understand by means of it, for the same reason it may become the form of some other man who will likewise understand by its means, the result being that at the same time two men will understand by means of the active intellect, as their form. But this implies that the active intellect's act of understanding is the act of understanding of the man who understands by its means, as already stated, and consequently two who understand will have one act of understanding, which is impossible. Moreover, his reasoning is altogether frivolous. First, because, when the generation of a genus is perfected, its operation must be perfected, yet in keeping with the mode of that, but not of a higher genus. For when the generation of air is perfected, it has generation and complete upward movement, yet not so as to be moved towards the place of fire. Likewise, when the generation of the habitual intellect is complete, its operation, which is to understand, will be complete, according to its mode, but not according to the mode of understanding in separate substances, so as to understand separate substances. Consequently, from the generation of the habitual intellect it cannot be concluded that at some time man will understand separate substances. Secondly, because it belongs to the same power to complete an operation and to perform it. Consequently, if the perfection of the habitual intellect's operation be to understand separate substances, it follows that the habitual intellect sometimes understands separate substances. But Alexander does not hold this, for it would follow that to understand separate substances comes to us through the speculative sciences, which are comprised under the habitual intellect. Thirdly, those things that begin to be generated, for the most part, are completely generated, since all generations of things are due to definite causes, which produce their effects either always or in the majority of cases. If then, completeness of action follows completeness of generation, it follows that complete operation accrues to things generated, always or most frequently. And yet those who study in order that habitual intellect may be engendered in them do not succeed in understanding separate substances, either in most, or in all, cases. In fact, no one has boasted of having attained to this point of perfection. Therefore, the perfection of the habitual intellect is not to understand separate substances. Chapter 43. That we cannot understand separate substances in this life, in the manner suggested by Averroes. The greatest difficulty presented by Alexander's opinion was that he supposed the habitual intellect to be altogether corruptible. Averroes thought to offer an easier proof that at times we understand separate substances, in that he deemed the possible intellect to be incorruptible and substantially separate from us, just as the active intellect. First, he shows the necessity of admitting that the relation of the active intellect to those principles which we know naturally is either that of agent to instrument or that of form to matter. For the habitual intellect whereby we understand, has not only this action which is to understand, but also this which is to make things actually understood, for we know by experience that both are in our power. Now, to make things actually understood indicates more specially the habitual intellect than to understand, because it is necessary to make a thing actually understood before one understands it. Now, in us certain things are made actually understood naturally, and not by study or by choice, as the first intelligible principles. And it does not belong to the habitual intellect to make these actually understood, for it belongs to this power to make actually understood those things which we know by study. Rather are they a beginning of the habitual intellect, wherefore Aristotle gives the name of understanding to the habit of these principles. And they are made actually understood by the active intellect alone, and by them those other things are made actually understood which we know by study. Accordingly, to make these things which are by way of consequence understood actually, is an act both of the habitual intellect, as to first principles, and of the active intellect. Now one action does not proceed from two principles unless one of them be compared to the other as agent to instrument, or as form to matter. Consequently, the active intellect must be compared to the first principles of the habitual intellect, either as agent to instrument, or as form to matter. How this may be possible he explains as follows. Since the possible intellect, according to his opinion, is a separate substance, it understands the active intellect and other separate substances, as well as the first principles of speculative knowledge, and consequently it is the subject of both. Now whenever two things come together in one subject, one of them is as the form of the other. Even so, since color and light are in the diaphanous body as their subject, one of them, namely light, must be the form of the other, namely color. And this is necessary when one of them is ordained to the other, but not when they are united accidentally in the same subject, as whiteness and music. Now the object of speculative knowledge and the active intellect are mutually ordained to each other, since these understood speculative principles are made actually understood by the active intellect. Therefore the active intellect is related to these understood speculative principles as form to matter. Consequently, since these same principles are joined to us by phantasms, which are a kind of subject thereof, it follows that the active intellect also is joined to us, being the form of these principles. When therefore these principles are in us potentially only, the active intellect is only joined to us potentially. When some of these principles are in us actually and some potentially, the active intellect is joined to us actually in part, and potentially in part, and then it is said to be moved towards the above conjunction, because as the more things are made actually understood in us, the more perfectly is the active intellect joined to us, and this progress and movement towards conjunction is effected by study in speculative sciences, whereby we acquire true knowledge, and false opinions are put aside, which are outside the order of this movement, just as monstrosities are outside the operation of nature. Wherefore men help one another towards this progress, just as they help one another in speculative sciences. And so when all potential knowledge has become actual in us, the active intellect will be perfectly joined to us as a form, and we shall understand perfectly by it, just as now we understand perfectly by the habitual intellect. Consequently, since it belongs to the active intellect to understand separate substances, we shall then understand separate substances, just as now we understand speculative knowledge. This will be man's ultimate happiness, wherein man will be a god as it were. That this explanation is of no account whatever is made clear enough by what we have already said, for it is based on many suppositions that have been already disproved. First, we have shown above, that the possible intellect is not a substance distinct from us in being. Hence it does not follow that it is the subject of separate substances, especially since Aristotle asserts that the possible intellect is the power of becoming all things, so that seemingly it is the subject of such things only as are made to be understood. Again, it has also been proved above that the active intellect is not a separate substance, but part of the soul, to which Aristotle assigns the operation of making things to be actually understood, which lies in our power. Hence it does not follow that understanding by means of the active intellect is the cause of our being able to understand separate substances, else we would always understand them. Further, if the active intellect were a separate substance, it would not be joined to us except by means of species made to be actually understood. According to his explanation, as neither would the possible intellect be united to us, although the possible intellect is related to those species as matter to form, while the active intellect, on the contrary, is related to them as form to matter. Now the species which are made to be actually understood are joined to us, according to him, by means of the phantasms, which stand related to the possible intellect as colors to the sight, but to the active intellect as colors to the light, as may be gathered from the statement of Aristotle. Now we cannot ascribe to a stone in which color is, either the action of seeing, so that it see, nor the action of the sun, so that it give light. Therefore, according to this opinion, we cannot ascribe to man either the action of the possible intellect so that he understand, or the action of the active intellect, so that he understand separate substances, or that he make things to be actually understood. Besides, according to this opinion, the active intellect is not supposed to be joined to us as a form, except through its being the form of the principles of understanding, whereof it is stated to be the form also because the active intellect and these principles have an action in common, namely to make things actually understood. Consequently, it cannot be a form to us, except for as much as the principles of knowledge have an action in common with it. But these principles have no share in the action of understanding separate substances, because they are species of sensible things, unless we return to the opinion of Avempes, that the quiddities of separate substances can be known by means of what we know of the sensible world. Therefore, no wise can we understand separate substances by this means. Moreover, the active intellect bears a different relation to principles of knowledge whereof it is the cause, and to separate substances, whereof it is not the cause, but which it only knows, according to his theory. Therefore, if it be joined to us through being the cause of principles of knowledge, it does not follow that it is joint to us, insofar as it knows separate substances, and clearly his argument contains a fallacy of accident. Again, if we know separate substances by means of the active intellect, this is not because the active intellect is the form of this or that principle of understanding, but through becoming a form in us, for it is thus that we are able to understand by its means. Now it becomes a form in us also by means of the first principles of understanding, according to his own statement. Therefore, from the very beginning man can understand separate substances by means of the active intellect. If, however, it be said that the active intellect does not become a form in us perfectly by means of some principles of understanding, so that we be able to understand separate substances, the sole reason for this is because these principles of understanding do not equal the perfection of the active intellect in understanding separate substances. But not even all these principles of understanding combined together equal this perfection of the active intellect in understanding separate substances, since all of them are not intelligible except in so far as they are made to be actually understood, whereas the latter are intelligible by their very nature. Therefore, although we shall know all these intelligible principles, it does not follow that the active intellect will become a form in us so perfectly that we understand separate substances by it. Else, if this be not required, we shall have to admit that by understanding anything intelligible, we also understand separate substances.